Hello, everybody. Welcome to Scholarly Podcast. This is episode 19. I'm your host, Sin Wong Chong. Today, I'm very, very happy to record in person in Oxford with our guest today, Dr. Talia Isaacs from University College London. Talia, very nice to have you here with us.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It'll be great to reflect and good to see you in person, too.
Great. Talia, would you mind briefly introducing yourself and your experience in journal peer review?
Sure. Yeah. So I've basically my first editorial board experience was as a graduate student. I received an IELTS Master's Award just shortly after completing my master's degree. My work became known by the editor of what was at that time a new journal. It's called Language Assessment Quarterly. It's now a well-established language assessment journal. And I was asked to serve on the editorial board as a student. At that time, I was an early phase PhD student. That was really formative peer review experience for me. At that stage, I'm not sure if I'd had any of my own publications, maybe one or two. But it's always good to sort of see and learn about the peer review experience from the other side as a reviewer or as an editorial board member. I subsequently became a member of other editorial boards, mostly in the area of language assessment, but also for the Journal of Second Language Pronunciation. In January of this year, I took on the role of co-editorship of Language Testing, which is a premier language assessment journal. I've really enjoyed that experience. I'm relatively new in the role, but I'm learning very quickly. And it's, again, a great experience to sort of now be in the decision-making chair and able to speak about peer review through podcasts like this.
Thanks. It's good to know a little bit more about you, especially your experience, not only as an author, but as a peer reviewer and also as a journal editor. Let's think about some of your unforgettable peer review experiences. First, as an author, and I'll leave it up to you to interpret the word unforgettable, positive, negative, or mixed. So as an author, do you have an unforgettable peer review experience?
Well, I'll start with my earliest peer review experience. I wouldn't say I'm terribly prolific, but I've had a long career and I have published consistently throughout my career. And the only time I've ever had an accept verdict with almost no revisions or extremely minor revisions was the first paper I'd ever submitted. It was to the International Journal of Inclusive Education. It was based on a term project that I did for my master's degree. And it sort of maybe was the easiest set of revisions that I've ever had to undertake. As an editor, it is very rare to see accepts with no revisions. So that experience, I think, was maybe not very representative of all peer review experiences. That was just a positive induction for me into peer review. Subsequently, I've had quite a difficult time finding a home for my work. A lot of my research, I'm a mixed methodologist. So I do research in both qualitative and quantitative traditions, and sometimes mixed methods papers were very difficult to publish. For example, I would get a qualitatively oriented reviewer who would say, put in more qualitative stuff. We need more substance. And then the quantitative reviewer would say, manuscript is good, but edit out all the qualitative elements. And, these were irreconcilable views, and it was very difficult to try to, sometimes the editors would not give a clear steer as to what they wanted. And I also had values that both qualitative and quantitative components should be included to tell a fuller picture of the story. So those were very frustrating experiences. I had one paper that went through, I think about 13 reviewers or something. It took years to finally get published. And that was a very frustrating experience. I did persevere, and it was very discouraging when we make comprehensive revisions at every phase, and then only to be given a new set of reviewers who didn't have access to the revisions that we'd made, and then who'd tell us to do different things or the same thing and round after round. I think in that case, the editor was a poor decision maker. And I think editors need to be decisive. They should not level all of the responsibility onto the reviewers. And so it was a situation where if one of the reviewers didn't, express some dissatisfaction with something, then the editor would just send it back and say, you know, okay, another round of reviews. And so that was very frustrating. I think, especially with topics that sometimes don't fit into the box, methodologically, or it might be substantively. I had experiences also with, you know, SLA journals and second language acquisition journals and language testing journals. And I'd send to one journal and they'd say, oh, this, publish this in a language testing journal. And then I'd send it to a language testing journal and they'd say, you're citing too many second language acquisition people, you know, for language testing. So I think the disciplinary silos, is something that authors, sometimes do come up against if they're not anchored in a specific tradition that fits squarely within one journal. So if you're marrying different traditions, that can be a challenge, and you need to learn how to write for different audiences.
I think there are quite a lot of things to unpack from what you said, but in particular, I'm very interested in reviewers' feedback on methods or methodology, because if it's comments on literature, adding a citation here, changing how data are presented in the piece, that's quite easy to fix. But the methodology or methods, the study has already been done, and it was enacted, and it's harder to change. So I wonder, from your experience, when you receive feedback about methods or methodology, how would you usually respond to that? Do you, like, defend your decisions, or would you really go after the suggestions of the reviewers?
No, I would robustly defend the decisions. I think in principle, for example, it would be, you know, for a mixed method study and a paper that comes out of it, it would be very easy to cut all the quotes and just present quantitative data, you know, figures and tables looking at statistical significance or whatever. And you could do that. But I think from a principled perspective, you know, the phenomena that I'm interested in are unobservable and tend to be quite complex. And the whole rationale for looking at mixed methods is that we need a more complete picture of the phenomenon of interest. And so we would argue that to the reviewers. I mean, I think the reviews, it just shows that reviewers come to reviews from their own perspective. They bring with that their own sort of worldviews and experiences. And so a reflection of a reviewer that says quantitative good, qualitative out, and vice versa, I mean, that's really the reviewer perspective. And so, no, I would rebut that. I would strongly say why I feel that the other perspective is enriching, and maybe point out a contradiction to the editor if that does exist. And in most cases, that is tended to, you know, either it gets rejected if, you know, that approach is not valued and we find another home for it, or it ultimately gets in. So I think it depends on the study. You know, sometimes it's easier to kind of, you know, if you have a study where maybe data collection was simultaneous or concurrent, it might be easier to place more emphasis on one element than the other. Sometimes authors also, you know, put the quantitative results in one paper and then save the qualitative for another paper. So it depends on how you want to do things with mixed methods, I think. I don't think there are easy solutions. I'm always cognizant of issues of data fragmentation and, you know, so I think these are all things to keep in mind. But no, if there's something that you in principle don't agree with, my suggestion would be rebut and then see what the editor decides.
I think that's very encouraging to hear. I think for doctoral researchers, early career researchers, I think they may not have that understanding that we can rebut or disagree with reviewers' comments. But from what you said, and from many of my guests previously, they all said that on reasonable ground, you know, it's okay to kind of say no with very strong reason.
Yeah.
And so that's very good to know. And it was successful eventually in most cases.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, sometimes it's not. For example, we came up against in-house rejections based on sample size when it was a mixed method study, and then may argue, well, it's a mixed method study. So looking at the number of, you know, participants in each cell that you would have for quantitative studies shouldn't also be applied to mixed method studies. So if they stick to something like that rigidly, then you have no chance and you need to submit elsewhere. But, you know, it's worth fighting that corner, and sometimes it bears fruit. Sometimes it doesn't, but you need to kind of, know where you can compromise, because you do need to make concessions as an author to the reviewers and to the editor. I mean, editors don't like when you completely ignore everything and you don't address things in detail in your response letter. Mm. But at the same time, you need to stick to your own principles. You need to know where your red lines are and where you're not willing to compromise. And ultimately, this is your baby. It's going in the public domain if it eventually gets published, and you need to be happy with that and maintain your own integrity as a researcher. So I think when you receive those reviews, you know, after you have a clear head, because sometimes you can respond emotively to the initial, you know, reviews, you'll have a sense of where you're able to compromise and where you're not.
Right. Thanks. Let's put on your peer reviewer and journal editor's hat.
Sure.
And think about any unforgettable experiences that you had.
Oh, I mean, unforgettable experiences as a reviewer. I mean, there was one case where I caught plagiarism. It was for a phonetics journal, and it was my first time reviewing for them. And I think maybe at that time they didn't use text matching software, but something looked quite fishy to me, or the wording just, I can't remember, or maybe it was a concept that I didn't understand. And I took the verbatim quote from the paper and just pasted it into a Google browser with quotes, and then found it on Wiki or something like that. And the editor was very grateful in that case that I caught plagiarism from the editor told me that they were very experienced authors as well. So this is not something that only happens with early career researchers. I don't know if it was intentional, and I'm not sure what the outcome of that case was, but I just remember that experience. I guess as editor, I mean, it's early days, but we've had, you know, experiences of authors submitting, two publications simultaneously from the same data set and not, letting us know about the other publication. And in one case, there was quite a bit of textual duplication, and it so happens that the reviewer had reviewed both. That's been a tricky one to deal with. I think there will be other such cases, but, I mean, these are recurrent issues, but I mean, of course, self-plagiarism is something that you need to make sure, is not present in your paper. And, you should, as an author, declare if you're using the same data set for multiple publications, or they're highly conceptually related, or if you have one paper, you know, that's maybe an extension of another paper, you should tell the editor of that in a cover letter. Or if you, as in that case, have two papers that are out for review simultaneously, editors need to know about that. So now our journal language testing explicitly advises authors to include that information in cover letters. Other journals may not be so explicit about their requirements, but I would suggest divulging that sort of information. Those are quite routine, but a couple of memorable experiences.
You mentioned self-plagiarism. Let's talk about that, because maybe some of the listeners are not really aware of what that is. So would you mind telling us a little bit about what you mean by self-plagiarism, or some other people call text recycling?
Yeah.
What does that mean? How can we avoid it?
I think for doctoral researchers, it's really important to get at some of the nuances here. So for example, let's say that you complete your doctoral thesis, and you know, it's in the public domain. It's an unpublished doctoral study, right? It might be on some, you know, like on your university library, or indexed as an unpublished doctoral dissertation through a web browser. Now, you can take chunks of text from your unpublished doctoral dissertation and put that into a journal article, and that is fine. That is not considered self-plagiarism. So it is absolutely okay to take sections of your dissertation and put that directly in a publication, be it a journal article or a book chapter. And what you would say in your cover letter, and probably in your acknowledgments, is you would just acknowledge that the paper is based on your unpublished doctoral dissertation at X university. So there's no issue with self-plagiarism with doctoral dissertations. We clarify that, by the way, on our on language testing guidelines. If you want to see sort of an example of how a journal advises authors about this, we have a dedicated section talking about doctoral theses, and same goes for masters. Okay, so that's one scenario. A second scenario is when you have a paper, okay, that has been published, and you're publishing a second paper on a similar topic, and you inadvertently take out chunks of text from the original paper, which is, again, it has been formally published, or it's under review, you know, for another journal or something, and you duplicate that in the paper that's under review for the journal. That is considered self-plagiarism. So effectively, the person that you're plagiarizing is yourself, right? You're taking out chunks of text. And, you know, there, of course, sometimes a degree of self-plagiarism may be unavoidable. For example, you may be drawing on the same data set, and the list of variables that you have is identical across the two papers. And usually that's okay. What you wouldn't want to see is, for example, chunks of literature review being identical in the two papers. So there are sort of, usually journal editors will, or editorial assistants will do some kind of screening process before your paper is sent out of review. Out to review. And if the paper's in the public domain, then typically text matching software would catch that kind of thing. But not always. But so as an author, the important thing is just to be mindful that you're amending the wording a little bit. And, also, of course, as I said, flag to editors that this is based on, you know, or that there is a related publication. And when you do that, you should also make a case for why the paper under consideration is novel. Okay. There are other cases of self-plagiarism. For example, if you have a published report, for example, and maybe it's a lengthy report, it's got an ISSN number, so it is formally published, unlike a doctoral dissertation, which is not. And you want to use a portion of that for a journal article, then again, you need to divulge that the report, that, you know, the paper is based on a report that's been published, and the journal would normally want to see something new that isn't already in the report. So it's a bit tricky to tease apart, but those are, broadly speaking, the main considerations. Right.
But that's very helpful, because I think for a lot of doctoral students, it's hard to draw the line. Sometimes they're not sure what constitutes that. So that's very helpful. I have added a new question here for all of my guests concerning ChatGPT, generative AI. So I wonder what your take is, your experience is, with ChatGPT or other AI software for journals. I mean, the implications for journal editing. There are more and more publishers and journals having an explicit policy on generative AI on their websites. I wonder if you can share with us maybe the case of your journal or your experience.
Yeah, I mean, watch this space. I mean, this is rapidly the use of, you know, OpenAI, you know, both, you know, that company and other sort of AI tools. I mean, they're readily available and in the public domain. They are being used. So journals have started to, I mean, TESOL Quarterly is one example in our field, have started to issue, as you've said, guidance for authors on appropriate uses of ChatGPT, and then instances where it's inappropriate. We haven't yet done this in language testing, but we intend to do so within the next year, I would say, just to see how things settle down. I mean, there are tools being developed to look at this as well. It is an actively changing space. So what I would say is, so, you know, I think I won't say too much about this because I'm still sort of formulating my own ideas. I think that it's unrealistic for us to think that ChatGPT won't be used, you know, as an initial, maybe first pass and packaging some ideas. I mean, certainly at the moment, if you were to ask ChatGPT to write the introduction of your paper, you know, maybe it would, it tends to be quite broad in terms of the characterization. So it would need quite a bit of finessing, I would have thought. Sometimes the ideas maybe may arise, and then the author can expand on that. I mean, I would be very cautious about the kind of, we've heard about bogus referencing that the, that ChatGPT and other AI tools produce. So they look credible, but, you know, typically editors would be able to catch that those aren't actual genuine references. So you need to be very careful with that. There are other uses of ChatGPT, that I think are unethical. For example, you know, using the tool for, you know, data, you know, to generate data. So that I think, you know, guidelines are certainly forthcoming, more than we have at the moment. And so it would be useful to see how things evolve with that. Certainly, it wouldn't be appropriate to acknowledge ChatGPT as an author. So you would never list ChatGPT as a co-author, but you would probably acknowledge explicitly how the tool has been used in an acknowledgement section or in a contribution statement. Language testing now has contribution statements. We haven't crossed over whether you would acknowledge AI in that way as you would an author. And I don't think that would be appropriate, but maybe just a brief acknowledgement of how you used AI in an acknowledgement section.
I think there's still a lot to think about because the technology keeps developing.
Indeed.
I think the bottom line is, you know, be transparent and be honest to acknowledge what role the AI has played in the writing process and the research process. I think that's very clear. All right. Let's go to another question. Going back to you, Talia, about your journey in journal peer review, how do you learn to navigate the peer review process? You mentioned your first submission to a journal was a very positive experience. But my question is, how did you decide to submit a piece of work to a journal? My understanding is that because when you did your doctorate, you did it by publication. So it may be slightly different from other students where you needed to publish. Is that the sole motivation for you to get involved in peer review, or there may be other factors?
I think maybe there are two questions there, but I'll broach the motivation issue before. I mean, maybe arrogantly, I always felt that I had something to say, something that I wanted to share. And, something that needed to get out there. I mean, it was in my head. And then I had to kind of work out a way of getting it down on paper. You know, I'd often present at conferences, and then that would be a springboard for then communicating that message more widely. And that was always important to me. I always wanted to drive change in the field, or to at least get people to reflect and think about different issues. And so, for me, that is what it's dissemination. And, I think dissemination is really important and different for us. Some peer reviewed and some non peer reviewed. So, for example, having a journal article published is very different than writing a piece based on that article for public consummation. For example, as an open, summary, right? An accessible summary that people more widely, maybe teachers, can access, that often isn't behind a paywall as well, but it's written in simpler language. It's more, you know, accessible to all, people who would be interested in your research. So I think that was what drove me to publish. I found areas where I just didn't feel the current state of understanding was adequate. And I wanted to, clear up some of the conceptual misunderstandings and add and contribute a way forward. And so that is the primary driver of publishing. I've only ever wanted to publish in areas that have been interesting to me, either substantively or methodologically. If I'm not interested in it and it doesn't get me excited, then I won't do it, generally speaking. So I think that's a motivator as to how to learn about peer review and, you know, go about submitting your first article. I think there's a philosophy that people just learn by doing, learn through osmosis. And I don't think that that's always the easiest. Maybe some people can do that. I mean, you're an example, Sin Wong, of someone who has learned how through trial and error to crack the peer review process. I don't think everybody is able to do that for various reasons. What was really valuable to me during my PhD was taking a research methods course. It was at McGill University in the psychology department, and or educational psychology. And we had an assignment where we had to effectively try to find a home for a piece of writing that we did. And it was not something that we submitted, but we went through the motions of you know, having a piece in mind that we wanted to get published, identifying or searching through journals, looking at, you know, the prestige of the journal, but trying to see if we could find an adequate home for the journal and going through some guided ways of doing that. So we, you know, we would look at things like, special issues and the kinds of topics. We would read the author guidelines, see what kinds of, how does the journal describe itself? What kind of audience, is the journal readership? How do we write for that audience? And what we would do is we would try to find, effectively three homes for each paper. Mm-hmm. So maybe the paper gets rejected from the first one. So we'd end up with a rank ordered list of the top three journals that we would potentially target, to get something published. And then think about things like, what is the slant of the journal? How would, what, you know, in our paper, how would we write the paper in a way that will be compelling to the journal readership? To the, because, a major source of internal rejections is the article not fitting the scope of the journal. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to do that initial homework. Look at who, you know, look at who's on the editorial board as well. What does that membership tell you about the, I mean, sometimes it's very varied in terms of interests, methodologically and substantively, but it gives you a bit of a flavor of, you know, the community, of practice, really, and the kind of look at who they're citing, the kind of literature, comes out, and then, you know, and then try to see about pitching your article accordingly. I think in our role as editors, we've come to realize that, there needs to be some guidance. For example, for, new peer reviewers on how to write peer review reports. That's not something that is self-evident, and it can be helpful to have a few exemplars. So, I'm hoping that within the next year or so, editors of major language testing journals will come together to try to come up with some guidelines. Maybe produce a few exemplars of peer review reports, and this would be a cross-journal initiative. Mm. So I think that understanding what reviewers are looking for is an important thing for authors to be aware of as well. And then also getting feedback from more senior researchers. So if you can get a supervisor to look over just even a quick eyeball of a draft, they'll be able to point out some things. I mean, I always would send my students, templates, for example, letters to the editor on, you know, and so on and so forth. So, I think, it's important for, you know, early career researchers to seek out guidance where you can, where it's available.
I really like some of the practices that you have been doing with your students. I think from my conversations with a lot of the guests, they think like, having that hands-on experience is important. The same that having some sort of support or training or input is important. And it's interesting, we think about universities supporting academic writing with workshops, retreats. We don't really have those things, and at least in my understanding, for journal peer review, for example. So it's amazing when I heard that kind of activity that you did, you know, identifying potential journals and also, you know, having potential exemplars, because I think even for reviewers, even though they receive each other's reviewers' reports for some journals, they don't necessarily constitute good examples of reviews, right? So there's nowhere they could learn from. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an excellent suggestion.
Yeah. Simwang, I was just going to add that as a reviewer, sometimes I've been maybe too busy to take on reviews. So what I've done is in that case, written the editor and said, you know, can a student of mine do the review? Right. So they are given credit for doing the review.
Right.
They do the review, and then we meet. I meet with the student. I will have read the paper myself, and then I will give the student feedback on the review. Mm. And then we finesse it, and then they submit the review. So they have an experience where they effectively have a more senior reviewer mentor them through that process. And it ends up being a great experience, I think.
I think that's an excellent idea. I mean, that kind of collaboration and learning from you, but also getting formal credit for doing the work, I think that's excellent.
It's very important.
I have another question about submitting manuscripts to journals in different disciplines. I think you're in a very good position to respond to that about disciplinary practices of journal peer review, because you submit to journals in medicine, for example, healthcare, language testing, and So I wonder what your observation is about disciplinary journal peer review practices.
Oh boy, that is a big topic. I mean, there are differences. The assumptions that I held as an applied linguist were really massive, radically challenged. Yeah, I think even within applied linguistics, there are major differences in terms of genre. The style of writing, in one journal to another journal can be radically different. Certainly when you go across disciplines, this is also the case. When I started writing, articles for medical journals, my writing was considered quite florid and they wanted a more succinct writing style, much more to the point. So you kind of have to, and in that case, one of the co-authors was someone who was from that community who was able to give me that feedback because I was able to go to the articles and learn some things just by observing, but I needed feedback from someone, who could look at it and say, oh, this isn't how we would do this in our field. You need to be more succinct. And, so that was very helpful. So if you are planning to publish in an interdisciplinary journal, get someone on board who's from that community who can help you with stylistic things. Authorship is different. Last author is prestigious in medical journals. That's not the case in applied linguistics. There are a host of differences. Often obviously referencing conventions. It is very important, whatever journal you're submitting to read the author guidelines.
Thank you. My last question, Talia, about your advice to early career researchers and doctoral students who may be thinking about submitting their first manuscript to journal and they hesitate, they think it's never ready, they don't know when it's going to be ready. What would you say to those students?
Well, that is something that often I have encountered with students previously. I naively thought that the enterprise of submitting a paper to a journal was just a matter of clicking a button and learning how to do it. And actually, that's not always the case. Sometimes there's a psychological component as well, where, as you said, students never feel that it's good enough or ready or are afraid of rejection. You have to be kind of tough-skinned, and you have to be able to and willing to take the risk, I think, because, our work is very close to us. And I think you kind of have to understand that in the academic world, people are tough. Sometimes there are fine lines between being tough and being unprofessional. Being unprofessional is unacceptable, but sometimes reviewers are tough. They are frank and they can, give you feedback that, and you may think that your paper is the best thing in the world. And they may give you feedback to suggest that they, wholeheartedly disagree. Mm. And that can be very, very difficult to take. And some authors, prospective authors, I think are quite intimidated by the whole process. And, there's an element of perfectionism I've seen in some people, as you alluded to as well. And I think it's important to just, understand, be a bit pragmatic about it. Understand that, you really have nothing to lose. You gain from the experience of crafting a manuscript. Maybe taking a paper out of your PhD and seeking getting it published, and you'll learn a lot. You'll learn a lot from the peer review experience. Some experiences are more positive than others, but you'll get an external opinion on your work, and you'll bank that experience. And it is a springboard for the next sort of attempt at publishing. So I always think it's good to have a plan of a few journals that you submit to. So sometimes you might submit to a tier one journal, and then you realize through the comments from the editor or the peer reviewer that actually it's not of the caliber for a tier one journal. And then you realize, okay, well, I'll submit to sort of a second tier journal. And that's okay. That's a starting point. We can't all produce, tier one quality manuscripts all the time, including experienced scholars, by the way. Mm-hmm. So, you give it a go. Make sure it's not a parasite journal, though. Make sure it's a credible journal. So I think just losing your nerve and going for it is important. But it is helpful to have sort of mentors around to attend sessions. I mean, often we have sessions on how to get your papers published at conferences. Go to those. I mean, those, there are a lot of pearls of wisdom.
Yeah.
I think, learn as much about the peer review process as you can. I mean, I always advise my students to have a good grounding on the American Psychological Association guidelines. Just to read through about, if you're in doing, you know, a social sciences paper about sort of, conventions in the field about how papers are structured. And there are some differences across fields, but it's good to have a grounding in, stylistic things like how papers should be written. What are the conventions in terms of referring to participants rather than subjects? So there, it's a really valuable resource. And then if you have that background, you'll then bring that to your writing experiences. I think it can be an asset. The main thing is also to just get to know the journal, and read the author guidelines and do what they say and make sure that you're, you know, that what you do submit is polished so you don't get a manuscript returned to you.
Yeah. I think that's very good advice, especially when we think about writing for a journal audience, which is quite different from writing for your Viva committee. So I think it needs to be tailored. So thank you very much, Tally, for sharing your experiences. Thank you for your time. And thank you everybody for listening. This, you just listened to a conversation that I had with Dr. Tally Isaacs, who's associate professor at University College London. Tally is also the co-editor of Language Testing. So thank you, Tally.
Thank you.